This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. What right does the state have to control a woman's mind, her life, and her body? That debate continues today, fueled in part by a literary masterpiece that has not gone out of print since it debuted in the 80s. Ask some fans what they think of The Handmaid's Tale, and they'll answer with a mix of reverence and revulsion. Reverence for the gripping tale by Margaret Atwood, and revulsion at the parallels they see in today's times. We'll never know how many people have seen themselves in Offred, the live-in slave used to bear children in a totalitarian state crippled by infertility. Offred's tale has spawned a movie, an Emmy-winning television series, and a cultural conversation about America's future. Now, perhaps state-sanctioned slavery and using women as breeding stock sounds fantastical, but we've done it before. Who's to say we could not do it again? Margaret Atwood is still thinking about what could happen in Offred's world and in ours. Her new novel is a sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, set 15 years later. It's called The Testaments, and it comes out today. Margaret Atwood joins us from the CBC in Toronto. Margaret, welcome to 1A.
Thank you very much.
Before we dive into the new book, I'd just love to know generally where your head is at right now with regards to this overall story arc. What do you make of the success of the original and the need to continue the story?
Well, when I first published it in the 80s, we thought we were moving away from the world of The Handmaid's Tale. But now we have the feeling that we're moving back towards it. So I think part of the success is people responding to their perceptions of the real world, that in a number of countries, not just the United States, but several other countries as well, things are getting ominously close to The Handmaid's Tale, though maybe without the outfits.
Let's talk a little bit more about the roots of the original story. You wrote The Handmaid's Tale in 1984, released it in 1985. As I understood it, it began when you were living in West Berlin.
When I actually started typing pages. But I noticed, because I was going through my old notes in the Fisher Library in Toronto recently, I noticed that I started thinking about it in 1981. So I put it aside. I just tried to write a different novel that didn't work out. And I actually started typing on it in 1984 in West Berlin when the Cold War was still on and the Berlin Wall was still up. So when it came out, there were a couple of different responses to it. In the UK, the United Kingdom, people said generally jolly good yarn. They didn't see it as a reality. And in Europe at that time, they didn't want to see it as a reality because the United States was the beacon of freedom, liberty, light, and democracy as far as they were concerned. In Canada, just north of you, they said, could it happen here? And in the United States, they either said, don't be silly, it would never happen here, or they said, how long have we got? So already there was some perception then that things weren't necessarily happily going along the yellow brick road to the Emerald City of Oz, because we were in the decade then of pushback against 70s feminism.
Was there anything in particular, was there a moment or a happening or an interaction that kind of sparked the writing of what we now call The Handmaid's Tale? Was there kind of anything that led you to say, okay, I got to start writing this now?
I think it was reading newspapers and magazines and looking at some of the things people were saying they would like to do if they got the power. And it was that and a couple of conversations I had with people of the do you know what they're trying to do kind. So it was a reaction to current events at that time, but it was also the fact that I knew from having studied it that the United States did not begin as a democracy; it began as a theocracy back in New England under the Puritans.
We asked folks what The Handmaid's Tale means to them, and we, not surprisingly, heard from quite a few of our listeners. Here's what Jeff left us through our app, 1A Vox Pop.
In 2007, I was in a long-distance relationship, and we read both Watership Down and The Handmaid's Tale together over the phone. And we did actually get married about a year later, and we've been married ever since, 11 years now. And so for me, it's obviously a powerful source of memories for the early days in our relationship. And it's also created sort of like just a big part of the common culture that we share just between the two of us to refer back to and discuss issues and things in our lives and in the world today.
Jeff, thanks very much for sharing your story. Margaret, I wonder at what point you kind of realized that The Handmaid's Tale had become part of the common culture, that it was something of a touchstone for Americans, for sure, but people around the world to point to something they couldn't quite articulate. When did that hit you?
Well, not all at once, and really not at the beginning when the book was first published, but it gathered steam over the years, and I would say it really began to get ominously close in the 21st century. So right after 9/11, things changed quite a lot. I think people became more frightened, they became more security conscious, and that usually makes people more conservative. So we had a couple of elections in which people used The Handmaid's Tale as a reference point. That is, The Handmaid's Tale is not a blueprint. Somebody tell the Republicans that The Handmaid's Tale is not a set of rules, things like that. But I think it wasn't until 2016 that it became so close in people's minds that it generated a huge amount of interest. And when the television series hit in April 2017, that became very large indeed.
Yeah, we definitely want to talk about the television series in just a moment. Let me get to a few more of our listeners' comments. Martha wrote on our Facebook page, "I remember reading The Handmaid's Tale during the summer between 8th and 9th grade 32 years ago and being terrified. It seemed like it could possibly happen, but I also knew even then that I couldn't live in a world like that. I remember seeking out my mom for comfort. She reassured me that society was moving in the right direction. I think I need to give mom a call again." Chelsea tweeted, "I never read the book expecting a sequel. I read it more as a commentary on society. Why now? And does Atwood hope to update her original story a bit to include more intersections of identity?" Margaret, what would you say to Chelsea? Why now?
Why now? Why now? Because instead of moving away from Handmaid's Tale, we're now moving towards it. That's one why now. Another why now is when people said, "Will you write a sequel?" I always assumed, and they assumed, that we were talking about a continuation of the narrative in the same voice, which I would not have been able to do. But then I thought, let's find out what happened to Gilead, because we know in The Handmaid's Tale it didn't last forever. So how did it all fall apart? How do totalitarianisms fall apart? And what about people who are opposed to them but still living within them? What do they do? And I also wanted to know what happened to the two children in the original story, because there they were inside Gilead. What was going to happen to them?
So the Handmaid's Tale sequel, The Testaments, comes out today, set in that fictitious city of Gilead where Offred's story takes place. Without giving too much away, since it just came out, what can you tell us about the novel in terms of the characters, the writing style?
Yes. So there are three different characters. They're very different. One of them is an older woman with quite a lot of power. One of the chief aunts. We've met her before, but we only ever saw her before from the outside in the original book. Now she's writing a little story of her own secretly, and that would be Aunt Lydia. And the other two characters are much younger, and they are those young people that I was just speaking about. And of course, there is a fourth character, because The Handmaid's Tale ends with a symposium, and now we have the 13th symposium, in which Professor Peixoto reveals that he's discovered some new materials.
Yeah, I was always interested by the fact that the book is kind of written reflectively by the end. They're kind of reflecting on Offred's story, so it's almost as if the characters know and or hope that someone in the future will find their story and learn from it. It's almost as if you kind of built the story to telegraph that this is a warning, that I'm trying to warn you about what has happened so you don't do it again.
Well, partly. As for people writing their testimonies and hiding them and hoping that people will find them in the future, that has happened a lot in the past. And it happened a lot in World War II. In fact, they're still finding those manuscripts now. So it is a... When you're in those situations, you can't see yourself necessarily getting out of it, but you want other people to know what happened.
Do you see yourself in any of the characters?
Myself?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not living in a totalitarian theocracy, number one.
But I mean, do any of the characters' stories, their behaviors, their actions, their motivations, do you see yourself in them at all?
Well, everything you write goes through your head in one form or another, but... Oh, that's very different from saying it's in any way autobiographical.
Well, I do want to know more about the way that you put this story together and the motivations behind the testaments when we continue in a moment with Margaret Atwood, the renowned novelist behind The Handmaid's Tale. The sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, The Testaments, comes out today. Coming up, we will hear from the creator and executive producer of the television adaptation of The Handmaid's Tale that is on Hulu and has won a number of Emmy Awards. And we'll get to some more of your questions and stories as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're speaking with Margaret Atwood, the renowned author of the novel The Handmaid's Tale. We'd love to hear from you if you've read it or seen the TV adaptation. We'd love to know what the story means to you and whether the themes in the story intersect with what's going on in the world today. Also, there is a sequel to the book called The Testaments. Anything in particular you're hoping to see or hear or learn from the sequel? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. In a moment, we'll be speaking to the executive in charge of the TV adaptation, so fair warning, we'll be discussing parts of the series that carry the story past the original novel. That might be a bit of a spoiler if you've only seen season one, so if you'd like to hear the rest of that conversation later, you'll find it online at the1a.org. Let me pick up with the real-world aspect that people take away from the story, Margaret, because we heard from a lot of listeners who've read The Handmaid's Tale and expressed real fear that the themes from the novel are happening right now. Totalitarianism, the rollback of women's rights, the end of reproductive autonomy. How far do you take the parallel in terms of what you see? I think it's very easy for us to kind of fall into a rabbit hole of, well, it's the beginning of the end, I guess we're done, but how do you see it?
Well, if we were done, you and I would not be having this conversation, number one. And number two, you still have elections in which people can vote, and women still are allowed to read and write, and they have access to higher education. So none of that would be true if we really were in Gilead. But it has been true in the past, and it is true in other countries. There is one thing that totalitarianisms always do. They always roll back women's rights, no matter what else they may not have in common. That is one thing they have in common.
I think it's safe to describe The Handmaid's Tale as a dystopian fiction, kind of a speculative fiction that imagines a world where things have gone sideways. What are your thoughts on how this genre has kind of evolved and where it's going? It seems like it's not new, of course, but... In the last few years, there have been a number of dystopian stories that have really kind of, you know, got people's attention and really kind of captivated the nation.
Okay, so the 19th century, when people really did believe in ongoing progress, because they had invented a lot of new things like steam engines and sewer systems and vaccination. So they saw that continuing on. So they wrote lots and lots and lots of utopias about future wonderful worlds. And that came to an end I was going to say with World War I, but actually just before then we started to see dystopias coming in, that maybe progress was not inevitable and maybe things were not going to be so rosy in the future. And after World Wars I and II, it became almost impossible to write a utopia. Dystopias did get written. So I'm thinking of 1984 and Fahrenheit 451. People were writing those. Then there was a pause, particularly around the late 70s and through the 80s and 90s, except for The Handmaid's Tale and a few others. But it wasn't a popular thing to be doing. Now, however, we're seeing two kinds of dystopias, both of them generated by real-world situations. One is called cli-fi, climate fiction, and those are based on the deteriorating condition of the planet. And the other scenario is a group of books that we might call Descendants of Handmaid's Tale, in which different aspects of reproductive rights for women and the situation of women, different aspects are examined, some of them pretty realistic.
What was it like for you as a Canadian to write about a dystopia in America, particularly because Canada is one of the places where the characters attempt to seek refuge?
Yes, well, Canada has been that place time and time again. It was where you wanted to get to on the Underground Railroad, and it was a destination for draft dodgers during Vietnam. I think 200,000 of them came to Canada. And on other occasions, it has been that place. So that's nothing new. It would be that place. As a Canadian, I was simply going back to my roots, which were among those New England Puritan ancestors. So I get to say those things about them. And America did not begin, as I have said, as a democracy. It began as a religious, it began as a theocracy in the 17th century. And it's that theocracy is down there in the American collective psyche somewhere. In fact, it's popped up into view quite a lot recently.
There's something about dystopias as well, and I don't know if you see it this way, but it almost seems like one of the fundamental ingredients of a dystopian fiction is some kind of zeal, some kind of zealotry, some kind of, you know, unquestionable, very absolutist, black and white belief system that everything is kind of pinned against.
That's what entitles you to kill people, isn't it? So it has been typical of real totalitarianisms that we have seen. And if you would like a rundown of them, get hold of Madeleine Albright's book called Fascism, A Warning, because she goes through the signs and symptoms and a lot of real-life examples, not confined to Hitler and Stalin and Mussolini, but including people like Pol Pot in Cambodia, and on and on. Argentina under the generals, they were notorious baby stealers themselves. So there have been a lot of them, and that is one of the things they do. They always have an overreaching narrative that makes them feel entitled to dehumanize other people and drop them out of planes.
There are a number of people who've also called The Handmaid's Tale a, and I'm interested to know what you think of this. Some have called The Handmaid's Tale a critique of second wave feminism, which began in the early 60s, kind of expanded feminism beyond legal rights to broader issues like family and the workplace, but in many ways rejected sexuality. Talk about that and where you see the book situated in kind of a larger feminist discourse.
Well, larger feminist discourse is going to get very large indeed, because you now have under that word at least 75 different kinds. So where to begin? It is true that in The Handmaid's Tale, women are promised safety from certain kinds of things. But of course, totalitarianisms do that, don't they? I wouldn't call it necessarily a critique of feminism. I would call it a book in which the regime does what those kinds of regimes do. They always set up separate women's bureaus, and they always contain women whose career is based on telling other women they can't have careers.
It's interesting to me because in the story, you know, women play just as large a role in this totalitarian society as men do. So it's not purely men subjugating women. There are women who are part of the system in various ways as well.
That's because it's a real totalitarianism, and therefore it's shaped like a pyramid. And at the top, there are powerful men, and right underneath them, there are powerful women, as in the aristocracies of Renaissance Europe. So a powerful woman, i.e. wife of a commander, probably has more stuff, you know, more goods and services, than an econo man at the bottom of the heap who has to make do with an econo wife who fulfills all functions. So at the top, you get more stuff. And at the bottom, you get less stuff. Does that sound in any way familiar?
A little bit.
Yeah. So it's not a world in which all men are having a wonderful time and all women are having an equally horrible time. It is hierarchical.
We talked on this program about a genre called hope punk, which centers on optimism as a form of resistance. You've clearly spent a long time thinking about dystopias through The Handmaid's Tale and now through The Testaments. Do you ever think about utopia, kind of the ideal world, a better world that you would like to see, or maybe writing about that?
Okay, as literary forms, every dystopia contains a little utopia. That is the thing that would be better than what they have now, or has been better. Sometimes it's situated in the past. And every utopia contains a little dystopia, because utopias are not universally wonderful for everybody in them. And if you've read a lot of them, you realize that sooner or later they have to come to terms with what do you do with the people that dissent. So they both have those kinds of problems, and one person's dystopia can look an awful lot like somebody else's utopia, depending on how they see themselves situated in it. And one question that you might ask the Steve Bannons of this world is, what kind of an ideal world do you want to live in? What would that world be like? I would be very interested in that answer.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Alicia wrote on our Facebook page, "Oh, you mean the documentary?" That's what a friend of mine said when I asked if they're watching the TV show. My husband and I are mid-season 3, and although I'm a fan of the book, the show is going further, and seeing it come to life is terrifying. It's often too graphic or upsetting for me to watch, but it's important too. The situations brought up are definitely things we need to talk about now. Alicia, that's a good place to add one more voice to our conversation as we continue with Margaret Atwood. Joining us now from Los Angeles is Bruce Miller, the creator and executive producer of the television adaptation of The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu. The series premiered in April of 2017. It wrapped production of the third season this August. Here is a scene from the first season in which Elizabeth Moss, who plays the main character, Offred, confronts an ambassador from another country. Offred's real name, by the way, is June. Her assumed name combines the words of and Fred, of Fred, Fred being the name of the man who's holding her prisoner. Here's that clip from season 1 of The Handmaid's Tale.
I lied to you. This is a brutal place.
Oh, Fred?
We're prisoners. If we run, they'll try to kill us. Or worse, they beat us. They use cattle prods to try to get us to behave. They rape me. Just every month, whenever I might be fertile.
I'm sorry.
I didn't choose this. They caught me. I was trying to escape. They took my daughter. So don't be sorry. Okay? Please don't be sorry.
Elizabeth Moss in a scene from season one of The Handmaid's Tale. Bruce Miller, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did this TV adaptation of The Handmaid's Tale come about?
I think people were interested in adapting it for TV as soon as it came out. It seemed like such a dramatic story. I read it when I was in college in a new fiction class, which tells you how long ago I was in college. But it was adapted to a lot of different forms, and I think that people were trying to kind of figure out how to adapt it, and it went through a few different hands. And then, you know, Kismet, just it happened to land at Hulu, and they were very interested when I happened to be available, which doesn't always happen. So really it was, you know, like many of these things, just kind of a collection of happy coincidences.
Now, when you adapt a book that is this big and this important, it's got to be, to put it mildly, kind of terrifying. I mean, Roots with Alex Haley, Shogun by James Clavell, those were huge books that turned into major adaptations that just kind of redefined television. The Handmaid's Tale must have felt a little bit daunting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it felt incredibly daunting. You don't want to mess it up. And I think, luckily, I was part of that audience. I really enjoyed the book, and I didn't want to mess it up either. So it's a lot easier when you're doing those things for yourself as opposed to a group of other people who you know, you don't know whether or not you align with their opinion. You know, just for me, I really enjoyed the book, and I wanted to bring it to life in a way that I found satisfying. But normally when you adapt a classic, the author is long gone, and Margaret's on the other end of this telephone.
Yeah, and Margaret, you were a consulting producer for the Hulu adaptation. Talk about what that role, a consulting producer, means and the involvement you had in this adaptation.
Well, apart from listening to Bruce tell jokes.
Other than that, yeah.
Apart from saying, you can't kill that baby.
So just kind of making decisions about what had to stay and what had
apart
to go.
Apart from saying, hands off Aunt Lydia. No, no, wait. No, I wasn't going to kill her. Honest.
So Bruce Marker kind of had to be your conscience and your editor? Is that
no,
part of it?
No, he wasn't going to kill anybody that I didn't want him to kill anyway.
So everybody died for a good reason.
Yes, apparently so.
Go ahead, Bruce.
I had no opinion about those other people that he smushed right and left.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Margaret, you know, for me, Margaret was just an incredible resource as a writer, because there are picky little questions that I had initially that only Margaret would have even thought about an answer. Why did she use the King James Bible instead of the Geneva Bible? Things that were so very much at the base of this stuff that no one would be interested. So in that way, Margaret was just a, you know, someone to guide me through the world. But I think, you know, the first season we were in very close contact. You know, I think that it basically was that there were things in the book that I was felt like I was going to have to change in one way or another, and I didn't want to do that without talking to Margaret. And it wasn't out of fealty to the book. It was more out of the fact that it worked as a story, and I didn't want to be pulling threads without talking all those things through. And I think after the first year, it became at least part of my process. Kind of, you know, halfway through the season, Margaret and I start talking about the next season in very casual ways, and it's, you know, kind of been part of the way that we've done the show.
I know we have to pause in a moment, but there's one other adaptation that comes to mind, and that's A Song of Ice and Fire by George R.R. Martin, and the challenge that Game of Thrones had once they started to write beyond the novels. That must have also been a bit of a creative challenge.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think you know, it's difficult enough to be writing, you know, the Handmaid's Tale series, you know, without, you know, someone writing another classic to go on the other side of you. But, you know, it turned out to be, at least from my point of view, and Margaret, please correct me, you know, she was very happy to ask me questions about what I was thinking about, and I was very happy to ask her questions about things that I was thinking about, and I felt very kind of, you know, she opened up her process to me in a very generous way, so nothing was very surprising, everything we kind of talked through. And as a fan of Margaret Atwood, it was very fun to kind of talk through her while she was writing to hear how that process went.
Stand by one moment, Margaret. I'd like to get your answer to that as well. And we'll continue talking about both the TV adaptation and the new sequel to The Handmaid's Tale in a moment. Stay close. We'll be right back. Back now to our conversation with Margaret Atwood, the author of The Handmaid's Tale and its new sequel, The Testaments, and Bruce Miller, the creator and executive producer of the television adaptation of The Handmaid's Tale, which is streaming on Hulu. Margaret, what about the adaptation? I mean, George R.R. Martin was interviewed by The Guardian about A Song of Ice and Fire, which was adapted into the HBO series Game of Thrones. And he said of the series, quote, "I don't think it," meaning the series, "was very good for me. The very thing that should have speeded me up actually slowed me down," unquote. And of course, he was writing more stories, trying to finish the saga while Game of Thrones was being a bigger and bigger hit. What was it like for you seeing this novel that had kind of stood as its own self-contained story, now not only being adapted, but expanded?
Well, it's happened before, because as you know, it was a film in 1989-90, and it's been a graphic novel, it's been a lot of plays. People just seem to do plays of it quite a lot. And it has been an opera, and it has even been a ballet, so I was very pleased by some of the decisions that they made. They adopted the same rule that I had, which is that nothing goes in unless you have a reference for it in real life or history. And they very courageously did it without makeup.
Oh, and I'm sorry, I just want to be clear on the reference in terms of nothing goes in unless you have a reference in history. I read somewhere that you didn't want the story to feel fantastical with, like, sci-fi weapons or...
Well, I also didn't want people saying to me, as people have said, how do you come up with this twisted so then I have to reply, it's not me coming up with it, it's the human species and it's 4,000 years of history.
Kind of grounds it in reality so people can't say, oh, that would never happen.
Oh, Margaret, you were so sick.
Yeah, exactly.
In a bad way.
Bruce, we heard from a number of our listeners about the television adaptation, some of whom kind of are challenged or take issue with the way some stories are adapted from medium to medium. Keisha commented, "I read The Handmaid's Tale as a college student in the 80s. Her treatment of the children of Ham, a white supremacist term for my people, meaning black people, felt so true that when I heard the TV show had a multiracial cast, I was quite disappointed. If the writers had been honest, like Atwood was, with how white dominionist-minded evangelicals view their ideal America, the show would have had much more of a punch." Bruce, what would you say to Keisha?
You know, I just was trying to adapt to the way the world has changed in the last 35 years. And I think, you know, it's just my own impression, but I think people are much more open-minded about adopting children of different races from their own. So, and I think that in a world where fertility had dropped so precipitously, I think what your listener was saying about the movement, I actually think it would change the same way I think people who never thought they would adopt a child that was a different race from their own have, and in every community. I mean, I don't know a single person who doesn't know somebody who has a child that's adopted that's from a different race. So I just think that over time that's been changing. I'm not making any, you know, I certainly am no expert on the Dominionist movement or, you know, Quiverful or any of the Christian movements, but it just seemed to make logical sense in a world with such diminished fertility.
There's that, but I thought also that Hulu has a diversity policy.
Bruce, can you speak to that?
They didn't articulate it to me, maybe because I had made the decision on my own, that I thought it would be more interesting to have a diverse world than an all-white world.
Let's play a quick scene from the first season of the Hulu series where we'll hear Fred, played by Joseph Fine, and Serena, played by Yvonne Strahovski, in conversation. It's a flashback scene when the two of them were planning the creation of the dystopian Republic of Gilead before they became Offred's captors.
Did you turn in your article?
No, I'm still working on it, but, you know, I was thinking fertility as a national resource, reproduction as a moral imperative. I think that's a really interesting idea, and it could make for a great second book. Or not. I honestly didn't think that I would ever write another book.
You should. It's a great idea.
Okay.
Hold this.
What?
It's happening.
They issued the orders. That's what we proposed. Three separate attacks.
When?
3 weeks. Congress first, then the White House, then the court.
Praise be.
Those are Joseph Fiennes and Yvonne Strahovski in season one of The Handmaid's Tale. Bruce, talk about the commentary that the show is making on reproductive rights and the autonomy that women have over their own bodies. How do you see that?
It's not intentional commentary. I mean, we took Margaret's world and we're extrapolating from it. And unfortunately, it's a lot more germane to what's happening in the current world than I certainly would like. So I don't think we are kind of bending any more with the current winds than anybody else who's listening to the news and involved in the world and all of that kind of stuff. We have a guide to go on, and I think that guide to go on is steering us more than current events. Unfortunately, current events are going in the same direction as Margaret's imagination.
What's it been like for you, Margaret, in terms of having people discover this story through media other than the novel? You said it's been adapted into, you know, a movie and a ballet and now into this television series. What's that been like for you?
Well, I'm very lucky in that the series is very well done. So it could have been quite horrible if it hadn't been. But as it is, it has a huge following and people are riveted by it, and that's because it is well-done television, not because it is owing particularly to my book, which could have been made into a pretty horrible show.
Let's play a scene from season 3 of The Handmaid's Tale. Again, we're discussing seasons that go beyond the narrative of the original novel, so there may be a few spoilers here. If you have not seen beyond season 1, you may want to listen to this conversation a little later. You'll find it online at the1a.org. But season 3 aired its finale in August of this year. Here's a scene from the season premiere, in which one of the handmaids, Emily, played by Alexis Bledel, is welcomed into Canada, where refugees of Gilead are gathered.
Hi, I'm Dr. Chung. You're safe now, and we're very glad you're here. We can only imagine what you've been through. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to make sure that the both of you are healthy.
I'd rather hang on to her. That's all right.
Of course it is. This way.
That applause at the end is from other refugees who've gathered to welcome her. That's the beginning of season 3 from The Handmaid's Tale. Margaret, the sequel novel that's just coming out, The Testaments, was that shaped at all by the TV show or the representations of your characters by the actors, or were they kind of two freestanding projects?
There aren't any radical contradictions, but The Testaments takes place 15, 16 years in the future beyond the period that the show is covering. However, we must say that Aunt Lydia, who is seen in The Handmaid's Tale, the book, completely from outside, completely by the single narrator, is given a lot of dimension in the show by the performance of Anne Dowd. And that, of course, added a certain flavoring to how I might be writing The Testaments.
Yeah, she was amazing. Anne Dowd was fantastic in this series. She was hard to watch, but she's hard to watch for all the right reasons. Bruce, I wonder if you respond to a comment from Lori, who wrote on our Facebook page, "In the show, what has resonated with me most is the information covered in the flashbacks. In them, we see that the transition to the current Gilead governmental control was incremental, with people viewing the initial changes as being annoyances and concerning, but didn't realize what was really happening until it was too late to mount a serious defense. The parallels between the fiction and the changes that are being made now as our current administration chips away a little at a time at freedoms and securities and protections are pretty obvious to anyone who is paying attention." Bruce, how would you respond to that, particularly because there are other shows like Years and Years on HBO that have kind of played with this same chipping away theme?
I agree. I love the flashbacks, and I love the flashbacks in the book because of the feeling of extrapolation that you feel like that the character of June in the novel, or Offred in the novel, is extrapolating out to a future, and when she's in the present, that wasn't what happened. And I think that for us, it's all about reading the signs. And I think in an interesting way, it's kind of that overlap between drama and curiosity, because the flashbacks are not necessarily dramatic because we know what happens. We know what the outcome is going to be, at least for June, in some way. But I think there's a huge hunger, there's so much hunger for more expansion of kind of how Gilead came to be and what the boundaries of Gilead are. And I think that really is a testament kind of to the complexity of Margaret's world that she created. But it is kind of endlessly fascinating at a time where people feel uncertain about the future to see another person uncertain about the future and making a wrong guess.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. One more scene we'd like to play from season one. This is more of the scene where Offred confronts an ambassador who's visiting from another country. The first voice you'll hear is the ambassador.
I am from Sipika, Ms. Offred. This nice city, maybe the size of Boston. There hasn't been a child born alive in Sipika in 6 years. My country is dying. My country is already dead.
Bruce, to what extent has your vision of this program been shaped by what we're seeing in our country, in our world right now? Is it a commentary on politics today?
No. I think that I'm I'm plugged into the way the world is working. We're all very news junkie over here on the writing staff. So I think that you can't help but be influenced by what's going on around you. But, I'm not a political commentator, and B, the timing doesn't work out. We're writing this show, producing the show, at least a year, a little bit more from when people see it. So current events are moving so quickly these days. I certainly would never presume that I could track that with that timeline. I'm sure you have difficulty at NPR when you can do it the next morning.
Sometimes. Yes. Although I think, for critics of the show, particularly more conservative critics of the show, they will look at the program, the reception it's gotten, the Emmy Awards that it's won. I mean, it's won Outstanding Drama Series. Elizabeth Moss has won Outstanding Lead Actress in a Drama. You've won Outstanding Writing in a Drama Series. I think it's easy for critics to say, see, there is that lefty liberal Hollywood again wagging its finger in the form of these TV shows, and it's the same old narrative. It's the same old song.
I don't know if conservative people see their movement in this show. I think that's a problem with their movement.
Constant progressive critique of the Trump administration. More like that.
The reason I really liked Handmaid's Tale from the beginning was I felt like it was actually common ground. We could all believe that this is a world we don't want. And in some ways, I thought it would be a nice place to start that conversation, which is, okay, we all agree that we don't want this, so what do we want? I certainly don't see Gilead coming. It doesn't seem to be that the pieces are in place. And I don't know that anybody, I don't think there's very many people who would want the world the way it is in Gilead. No one seems to be super happy.
I know our time is limited, but I'd like to know from each of you what's next. Bruce, first of all, what can you tell us about what's next for the TV show?
We're doing a season four. We are just beginning our discussions about what is going to happen. So we're just, following June along in her amazing story, following Elizabeth Moss where she goes.
And Margaret, what about what's next for you? I mean, the world has kind of retaken to this story in a pretty remarkable way. You see protesters of the Trump administration, protesters around the world, really wearing that Handmaid's uniform, the red robe and the white wings to their demonstrations. I wonder how that kind of influences the way you think about what's next for you.
I'm kind of old to be influenced by anything, but it's a brilliant choice of protest costume because you can't be kicked out for making a disturbance or for dressing immodestly. But everybody looking at you knows exactly what you mean. So I think that's why it's become so popular. As for the ongoing show, Bruce, you and I, we need to have a phone conversation pretty soon.
Yes, we do.
Don't we? And we will.
Then we will.
Yeah, please do have that conversation so we can keep getting more show. Please, please do that.
We'll do what we can.
In fact, I'll let you go to have that conversation in just a minute. But before I let you go, last question, Margaret, for those folks who read your book and think to themselves, well, that's exactly what I thought was happening. I think it's all over. This is just kind of the representation of what I was afraid of. For people who feel like we're done, what would you say to them?
These kinds of regimes don't last. And one of the things that interested me about Gilead was we know it falls apart. We know that in the symposium at the end of book one, but we're not told how. So I was interested in exploring how. So as Churchill said, it is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end, but it may be the end of the beginning.
That is the focus of The Testaments, the highly anticipated sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, which is out today. Margaret Atwood, it has been a pleasure. Thanks for talking to us.
And thank you.
And Bruce Miller, the creator and executive producer of the television adaptation of The Handmaid's Tale, streaming on Hulu. Bruce, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink and Avery Kleinman. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.